This evening, I am so overjoyed. It is with great pleasure, it is with delight that I introduce one of my good friends to give a talk this evening. And of course, one of the reasons for my delight is because I don't have to give a talk this evening. I could take a break and listen to a great Dharma talk from a great friend. Ajahn Pasano has now been a monk for over 33 years, I think one more year than me. And for nearly all those 33 years, he's been in Ajahn Chah's tradition. I do remember when I first arrived at Ajahn Chah's monastery, which was just after the New Year, so it'd be the first couple of days of January in 1975. Long time ago. That Ajahn Pasano had just arrived there. So we sat next together for the first few weeks. And so we've known each other now for about 32 years. And he became the abbot of Wat Banana Chat for about 10 years? 15 years. Time passes so quickly. And then afterwards he moved to the United States to start Ajahn Chah's monastery in Northern California. Just about 2.5 hours north of San Francisco, close to the town of Ukiah in Northern California, where he's now one of the co-abbots. And he's a very, very, very kind and gentle monk. Over all the years I've met him, very, 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 very rare for tall does he ever get upset. So I realized that when I asked him to give the talk this evening, he'd almost certainly not get upset again and say yes. So I'd like to welcome Ajahn Pasano, who is a Canadian-born monk, born in La Paz. La Paz? How do you pronounce that? La Paz? La Paz in northern Canada. And he went to Thailand in 1973.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Okay. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for the intro. Very happy to be here and visit you all. Of course, I've been hearing over the years of all the good things that have been happening here in Perth. I was here, I guess about 22 years ago, my last visit to Perth. And they just purchased the church next door. And they hadn't started using it yet. So it's been, the monastery in the center has been growing, and the community here has been responding in such a positive way, with commitment and interest. It's a delight to be here and to share Dhamma with you. I just arrived at the afternoon flight it was after four this afternoon, and I've been, last 10 days I've been traveling and teaching in Malaysia and visiting monks who've used to live at Wat Nana Chat in Thailand. And I'm going to spend a bit of time to visit here in Australia, both here in Perth, in Melbourne, and then go to see our associated monasteries in New Zealand as well. So just to for myself, taking the opportunity to come and visit these places that are associated with Ajahn Chah. And it's sort of like a kind of a big family, which is a very lovely feeling to be associated, to say, to come here as a basically a newcomer, and then to be welcomed. And this is say part of being part of a Dhamma community or Dhamma family, and that is that's very, very supportive to have this say association with good friends in Dhamma, good friends that support us in our aspiration in seeking truth, seeking happiness and well-being, seeking a way out of suffering. So the for yourselves, being a part of this community, sort of an opportunity both to receive the fruits of that, to receive the benefits of being part of a community of like-minded people who are committed to practice, to seeking, and then also to share, to give as well. It's a sometimes we don't recognize in ourselves that we're actually giving much or sharing much, in the sense that, oh, how could I do something as noble as sharing and being a good Dhamma friend to people? But just the fact of coming on a Friday night, being here, it's a support for everybody. It's an encouragement to bring the teachings into daily life, bring the teachings into your world. So I sort of commend your commitment, and it's very delightful, and also encourage that kind of recognition that you're both receiving something that is very nourishing and supportive, and then you're also, you have that opportunity to give and to share. I've spent the last just over a year in retreat. It's my time, my year for sabbatical, where I could put aside the mantle of being the co-abbot, looking after administration, teaching, because abbots do all sorts of things. Pick up the garbage, close the doors, close the windows. So just to set that all aside and have that time for retreat, for solitary practice. And it's been very nourishing for me to have that time. I spent it in Thailand. One of the reasons why I went back to Thailand, I've been in America now for 10 years, and just to be able to step away from what's familiar and what I've got used to, and with so many people that know me, then to go back to Thailand, where there's such a strong sense of faith and support for Buddhist practice. I don't have to, in America, and because it's a new monastery, then constantly having to You have to explain yourself. You have to. You're not just immediately seen as a monastic. So it was a nice break for me to be able to just to be bathed in that quality of faith. Because say faith in this practice is very, very important actually. It's something that we tend not to, especially in the West, we don't tend to think about it very much, or we tend to it tends to get downplayed a bit. I mean, it definitely is sort of takes the back seat to wisdom and the qualities of meditation. But you know, faith if one reflects on the qualities which the Buddha called the spiritual powers, faith or satta, confidence, is it's the first spiritual power. Faith, effort, mindfulness, meditation, concentration, samadhi, and wisdom. So that faith is that first quality that the Buddha brings up as a spiritual faculty. So I think it's important to be paying attention to how we're nourishing faith and recognizing that actually without faith, then we tend not to put forth much effort. Yeah. It's that quality of faith, of confidence, that gives us the willingness to put forth effort, to bring up energy in our practice. And like it isn't wisdom that gets you up at 4 in the morning. Or if you start trying to analyze it and think of all the benefits, by the time you've done that, you're already back to sleep again. it's faith. It's, okay, yeah, it's time to practice. And that you just go ahead and do it. So it helps to just make that leap of not thinking too much about it, not trying to analyze it, just doing it. I think the analyzing or the reflecting comes after, where you really start to assess and consider and see, well, what was the result? How did it work? What worked? What didn't work? But it's that initial impetus of faith that is what gets us going. So to recognize just the important role that faith plays, and then to pay attention to, well, what helps to nourish that, what helps to support that. Coming together and listening to Dhamma, practicing meditation together is a wonderful way to just support that quality of faith. And it helps to, as I said, nourishing. Where we need to pay attention to what we're being nourished by. Because there's the kind of food that we like, spiritual food for the heart, it's just something that it's a natural part of what is going to fuel our practice. And we're being nurtured, nourished, we're consuming things all the time. And, you know, whether it's on the level of physical food, of course, is very obvious. And we're, You know, we have to eat every day, and that gives us the energy to live our day-to-day life. But in the same way, we also need to sort of nourish or eat or consume things that are going to, say, support our effort and energy for what we, our aspiration, our goal. And and we do that through what we, you know, say, what we pay attention to in sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, what we pay attention to in terms of feelings, of our thoughts. And on a certain level, we're feeding on that all the time. We might not notice it. And we might not pay attention to it. But we're feeding on that. So you have to, in the same way that, it's like just before we came into the Dhamma hall, somebody offered a drink, to us. You know, beetroot and carrot juice and something really healthy. And and that's actually good, you know, rather than junk food. So that in the same way, we want to sort of look after our physical well-being by consuming, eating things that are good for us. On the level of our spiritual practice and on our day-to-day life, are we paying attention to what we're consuming? Are we paying attention to what we're eating? Are we recognizing that we're actually feeding on feelings, thoughts, moods, impressions, biases, opinions, views? Are they, and in that process, are we attending to the result? Are we looking at and trying to find the things that will actually, say, not be junk food for the heart and will actually nourish the heart in very wholesome, skillful, positive ways that lead to peace and clarity? Because it's what we feed on, it's what we consume, it's what we seek as nourishment, that's going to condition what the result is. So the fundamental desire or wish for all of us, whether we're lay people or whether we're monastics, whether we're young, whether we're old, we want to experience happiness and well-being, and we don't want to experience suffering and dissatisfaction. That's a basic foundation of our what motivates us. And when we have that basic aspiration or basic impulse, then we do need to use our ability to be attentive, to watch, to be careful. And that's one of the qualities that the Buddha pointed to actually in his very last admonishment or teaching as he was passing away, and that the all things are impermanent or dissolving, disintegrating. Be heedful, be careful, be cautious, be circumspect. The Pali word is apamada. So just learning how to bring in that quality of being very, very circumspect in what we do. Because it has results. It has everything has a result. So that when we seek the nourishment of the things around us, whether it's physical or through the senses, through the moods, and we really want to be attending to and choosing skillfully those things that are going to support our wish to experience happiness and well-being and to free us from suffering. So that one of the basic qualities that we always need to be attending to is just the quality of mindfulness. And I remember when I about 10 years or so ago, I did another long retreat, and I was in England. And I was at the Chidhurst Forest Monastery, living in the forest, and I didn't need to be engaged in any of the activity of the community. I'd come over for the meal, and then I would go back to my dwelling place in the forest, practice meditation, walking meditation, sitting meditation, reading Dhamma, and then the day would pass, the night would pass, next morning, go for a meal again. That was the cycle of the days of just practicing and developing awareness, mindfulness. And there was a lay supporter who I'd known for many, many years. She came down to visit and saw me at the meal, asked how I was doing, what I was doing. By that time, I'd been in retreat for 6-7 months. So I just gave her a brief outline of what I was doing. And she looked aghast. I said, "That sounds boring." and by basic standards of normal human existence, yeah, I guess it is. But I said, you know, you have to realize that boredom is really, you'd only get bored when you're not mindful. And you recognize that if there's mindfulness that is being sustained, that you're dwelling with awareness, attention is sharp and clear. The mind is very full. The heart is very satisfied, very bright. And in reality, so much of our attention gets drawn out, trying to be happy, trying to be pleased, trying to be satisfied, trying to be gratified, trying to have excitement, and it's done in an unmindful way. And we get drawn into the habit of that. So, to learn to pay attention to the habit and the tendency that we have for just seeking a kind of nourishment or satisfaction, pleasure, in the world around us. World of the senses, world of experience, or in the our own sort of churning it over in our mind. So to recognize that so much of what we're seeking and thinking that it's going to satisfy and gratify tends not to have that result, and basic reason is just lack of mindfulness, lack of attention, lack of awareness, because we don't recognize what we're doing. So to begin to start to pay attention in very ordinary ways. Now, am I attentive to what I'm doing? What do I do? What's my habit? When it's like, what do I do when I go home, walk in the house? What's the first thing? If somebody's there, you probably start a conversation. If somebody's not there, it's either, you know, turn on the television, go to the refrigerator, turn on the computer. So, I mean, and those are, you know, we get drawn into things external. And just to say, it's not that extreme kind of heroic to just be present with what one's doing. Just be patient with being that kind of feeling that draw into doing something, doing anything. And then to be very mindful of that, to be willing to watch it, to be willing to attend to it. And you don't need to try to annihilate any desire that comes up. You don't need to try to fight and struggle with whatever is there, but to be willing to be attentive. Because then you'll start to recognize the more clear you are, the more clearly you can attend to things, then the more you recognize that the result of what your actions are, the result of what the what you feed on, what you seek as nourishment. And that's something that is, you start realizing that the kind of that what we're seeking in practice is really to return to ourselves, really to be willing to be present with ourselves. It's like there's a senior monk in the south of Thailand, Ajahn Buddhadasa, or he's passed away now, and there was one time. And he was considered a great master, great meditation master, great scholar, wonderful wealth of just an example of being a spiritual leader and practitioner. And this one person came and he'd arrived at the monastery, bowed down, and then in this sort of exclamation of sort of religious fervor, just, you know, please tell me what I need to realize the wisdom. What do I need to rely on to develop to realize the wisdom of liberation? And Ajahn Buddhadasa looked down and said, well, just develop the wisdom that brought you here in the first place. Because we tend to overlook that. We're looking, you know, the Ajahn, please sort of pass on the wisdom to me, or, you know, looking to some experience outside, we tend not to pay attention to that internal wisdom, internal qualities, which we have within us, and that we can nurture, we can nourish, we can develop. So to starting to recognize what we need to attend to and practice and train with is within us. It requires faith, requires effort, requires mindfulness. It requires a quality of stillness, concentration. It's like the, when we sitting in meditation, to be willing to return to stillness. And that the different, say, levels of concentration, they all require a willingness to return to stillness. And that appreciation of stillness, it doesn't mean that we're going to be still all the time, or that we're going to try to force the world to be still, or force our minds to be completely still at all times in all circumstances, but learning how to appreciate stillness, learning how to recognize that, oh, that stillness really nourishes. When I return to stillness, there's a quality of well-being and contentment that is starts to arise. Or sometimes you return to stillness, and it may not be contentment and peace at all that arises. But what it does is highlight that. Because what might come up is strong impulse to desire to seek something, get out of this, or a sense of even anxiety, fear. The stillness is all of a sudden very intimidating. I wanted to be peaceful, and now I'm turning my mind to it, and then say, whoa, that's a bit much. it's a great opportunity to start recognizing, hey, well, what's underneath that? Why is that there? And do I want to nourish that? Do I want to support that? Or is that something that needs to be really understood and let go of? So that is that quality of stillness that starts to highlight and provide a backdrop, a mirror for what our mind tends to do, and what it can do, what its possibilities are. So that we really learn through stillness. We really learn. And that's, in the Buddha's teaching, one of the qualities that, how do you say, signifies or characterizes the path is it's a training. And it's like this is a training. And when the Buddha talks about the path in a sort of a synopsis of the path, and it's the Pali word is sikha, which is, it means learning, study, training. And if you reflect on the precepts, when we say precept in English, it's pretty loaded word, isn't it? It's a rule. And you better be careful about rules. But for the precepts in the Pali language, when you take them, it's like sikha padang. It's the basis of training. It's the basis of learning. It's the basis of being able to, because pada is base or foundation, foot, and this sikha padam. So it's like a training that we do. And that's when the Buddha talks about the path, then he talks about it as a, say, the training in higher virtue, the training in the higher mind, the training in higher wisdom. And that same word, sikha, runs through that theme. So that quality of training and recognizing that all of the different aspects of the path are a facet of training. And when we're taking precepts, we're paying attention to our actions, whether they're bodily actions, speech, how we relate to other people. Those precepts are a mirror to give us an insight, a recognition, a learning about what is it that is the benefit, what is it that is the drawback, what are the feelings of resistance we have, what are the feelings of the result of that. One of the things that the Buddha, when the Buddha talked about the five precepts, one of the ways he talked about it was, he said there are these five great gifts. And because they're gifts of giving freedom from fear, they're gifts of giving trust. And that is so that refraining from killing, refraining from stealing, refraining from sexual misconduct, refraining from wrong speech, refraining from intoxicants, this is a gift that we can give. And you reckon, and you think, oh, that's a new way of looking at it. That's a different way of looking at it. So that using precepts in a way that you're reflecting and investigating. Well, what are the results? What are the difficulties that I have with it? What are the things that are my strengths? What are my weaknesses? What do I need to be really careful with? Where do I need to be restrained? Where can I really take delight in something that is quite, there's really no intention or no movement towards compromising a particular precept. So that one could really delight in that. And, you know, where do I trip up? And I'm sure for everybody, you know, whether it's lay people or monastics, one of the first things we trip on, one of the first precepts to go is the precepts on speech. Just whether it's harsh speech or gossip or, the speech which is really not really useful, that is, you know, that tends to, there's a precept against it. So it's like using it as a mirror to say, well, why did the Buddha advise that? Why did he encourage that? And then recognizing the kind of the mental state that's involved in that turning, that willingness to transgress, the willingness to sort of push the boundary of that, or just falls into it out of habit. So you're really starting to learn about the mind, really starting to learn about, and it's that learning, that's what sikha is. When you say training, it's not just sort of regimenting yourself to a particular sort of standard which you've got to force yourself to comply with, but it's taking on a training so that you're really learning and understanding what is it that's beneficial, what is it that really supports that fundamental underlying aspiration. How do I experience happiness and well-being? How do I be free from suffering? And you know that's the, say, the path is supporting that, encouraging that, nourishing that. When Ajahn Chah was many, many times, he would be asked, how can you teach, because he had so many Western disciples, you know, how can you teach these Westerners? They don't speak Thai, you don't speak English, you know, how can you teach them? And it depends on his mood what he would answer, but one of the answers that really struck me was one day he just, you know, picked up a glass of water and said, okay, say this is a glass of cool water. I'm saying, but if you say that in Thai, then that's one thing. You go up to the northeast of Thailand where Ajahn Chah lived, and you don't use that word anymore. You use another word. It's a different, completely different dialect. So it's not really recognizable. So if you say it in English, then some people understand, some people won't. You say it in French, you say it in Chinese, you say all these different languages. They've got words for it, but it may not be clear what it is because you're using the words, you're using the concepts. But if you really want to know what this is, then if you stick your finger in it, and then you know, oh, that's what cool water is. It's an experience. So that the teaching, the practice, is around understanding experience. That's through training. You train, you learn, and you don't learn the language, you don't learn the words. I mean, they're helpful sometimes, but you're learning about the feeling, the experience. So that, you know, what is it that, you know, what does happiness feel like? What does suffering feel like? What does confusion feel like? What's the experience? What's the experience of peace? What's the experience of stillness? So that turning to the experience, and that's through training. You're not doing it from an intellectual analysis. You're not approaching it from a metaphysical discourse on it. You're coming back to fundamental experience, and then this is what training is about. Similar, I mean, another way that I remember one time Ajahn Chah answering that the question of whether how did he teach these Westerners who didn't understand Thai, and he didn't understand, he couldn't speak English, and saying, you know, just sort of kind of quite flippantly, really, he said, "Ma, it's not difficult to teach Westerners. Just like teaching buffalo. You pull them here, pull them there, and they learn." You know, so that quality of, it comes back to training. You know, that say even we as Westerners, who sometimes we could be pretty out of it in our ability to tune into what was going on around us, but you learn through experience. You learn through training. And it isn't through the ideals. It isn't through the philosophical analysis of things that's important. It's learning how to learn from experience, to train. And similar thing that Ajahn Chah, thinking again on this theme of nourishment or what we feed on, because we tend to be extraordinarily idealistic. That's part of Western culture. There's a very strong ethos of idealism, and ideals play a large role in the worldview. Whether that's on a religious or a political, the ideals are held very high. And I remember Ajahn Chah one time saying, you Westerners are like vultures. I said, look how high vultures fly. They fly really high. But look what they come down to eat. Which really hurt. But it's true, in the sense that sometimes the ideals can be so high, but then, it can very, very easily turn to intolerance, irritation, aversion, a sense of righteousness. And that tends to undermine, say, whatever good qualities we're trying to cultivate, trying to develop. So to pay attention to what are we eating? What are we coming down to feed on? It's those moods of aversion, ill will, desire, attachment, fascination, just anxiety, fear, boredom. All of this, if we absorb into them and obsess with them, that's what we feed on. That's what is nurturing us. So that we realize, and that's the function of wisdom, is to reflect, investigate, to discern. One of in English, the word that we use, wisdom, is, it's a noun, isn't it? And nouns are things. So that we're looking, when we're looking for wisdom, or we're trying to apply wisdom, the word wisdom is a noun. So it's a thing. So that if something is a thing, then it's kind of static. And then you're trying to sort of apply it onto other things. But the word in Pali, panya, is actually, its root is not a, it's a verb. It's like the verb of knowing or knowing clearly. When it's a verb, then there's an engagement. It's an ongoing activity that we're involved with. So that maybe discernment, wisely reflecting. I mean, it's hard, you know, sometimes with English, and, you know, you've got to play with the language to try to convey the feeling of what we're trying to do. So wisdom is something that you're trying to develop, trying to work with, trying to apply, trying to engage oneself with. One's engaging with wisdom, engaging with discernment, discerning. So that discernment of you know, what are the results of the actions, speech, thoughts, impressions, moods, feelings, and to be willing to train with that, willing to work with it, trying to recognize, well, what is, you know, how to, you know, what's the result? And then also an aspect of wisdom is also its, you know, what is the underlying kind of theme that wisdom is pointing to? What is its results? And the Buddha is always trying to point us in the direction of a relinquishing, of letting go, a setting down, a willingness not to carry things around, because we tend to clutter up the mind, clutter up the say the fundamental stillness and clarity of the mind with things that we don't really need to carry around at all, and that exercising of wisdom is the just the exercising of putting things down, not carrying it, not adding on to the mind, to the heart, a burden that really isn't needed, necessary, and isn't even wanted. We don't really want more clutter in our minds at all. We don't really want more suffering. We don't really want more confusion at all. So, recognizing that we can be doing something about it. And just that exercising and putting things down. And that quality of just not holding to a mood, not holding to a view, not holding to a protecting a sense of worry or anxiety. Because we tend to, you know, if we didn't have this mood, this feeling, this thought, you know, like, who would we be? Because we, you know, our whole sense of who we think we are tends to always be cluster around our moods, our impression, our feelings, and to recognize, well, no, we can put all that down, and then what's left? And certainly the from the Buddha's perspective and from the say the lineage of teachers, you know, what is left is peace, happiness, compassion, all of the things we're wanting. But you know, again, it said this is where it loops back into faith, because one has to have the faith to put it down and then recognize, well, what's the result? What's going to happen? What's going to happen when I let go of a mood? What's going to happen when I relinquish a desire? It's like, you know, that feeling of desire, wanting something, wanting to be gratified by something, wanting to enjoy something. And then what happens when we relinquish that? Now, the initial impulse, especially when you first start training, it's like, it's painful. But then you start investigating a bit more clearly and say, well, you know, I can let go of a desire, let go of a particular attachment, and I'm actually still a complete being. There's nothing missing anymore. Because the feeling is, you know, I've got to have this in order for me to be fulfilled, in order for me to be complete, in order for me to be satisfied. And then you realize, well, when you put it down, you started off as a complete whole being, and you put it down, and you're still absolutely complete. And it takes training and a willingness to watch and investigate, and then to just having the faith to, what happens? What happens when you do that? So then, this path of practice, this path of training that the Buddha laid down, when we referring back to nurturing or nourishing, I mean, the path nourishes the growth on the path, maturing in that which is wholesome, skillful, leading to well-being and happiness. So to be able to be willing to investigate it, recognize it, reflect on it, experiment with it, and then to see what happens. So this evening I've given some reflections. I offer them to you this evening. Well, I mean, that's way down the road. That's sort of like an ultimate goal, ultimate ideal. But again, that's where, how do we just learn how to nurture a little bit of stillness, a little bit of peace, and see if it's good for us, and see if it actually is satisfying, gratifying. Then that's what actually gives one the faith, confidence, encouragement to turn attention to those more refined aspects of the goal. It gives confidence in the goal, because you start recognizing in these the little glimmers, the little tastes that we get along the way are a precursor or an indication of what is possible. Certainly my own bias is that certainly where the path leads, but really to give oneself the encouragement to keep doing it.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to feel this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I want out of here. Yeah. One of the things to do is to pay attention to the body. I think it's really important to be grounded in awareness of the body. So often we try to solve our problems through thinking about them, or the feeling is very strong, so that the impulse is to the mind starts spinning out on particular feelings, impressions. So to be able to turn attention to the body and realize that whatever feelings we're experiencing, that they're reverberating in the body, and to pay attention to relaxing, settling, paying attention to how the particular feelings or reactions that are happening in the mind, how are they, what's it feel like in the body? So then that gives you a much more tangible base to work with, to train with the feelings. Because, our minds are notorious liars. So they're, you can't really trust them. But the body is much more straightforward. And also so that then there's a feeling of discomfort, a feeling of anxiety, a feeling of fear maybe. And then to pay attention to that feeling, to relax into that in the body, how we're experiencing it. And there'll be tension, there'll be a sense of, you know, whether it's in the, you know, the chest, the stomach, you know, the jaw, really to go through the body and really soften, relax, warm the body, to loosen, to let it be at ease. That you have to breathing through that, training with it. And it's very interesting that, you know, if you're really relaxed, you can't be kind of anxious or fearful. You can't hold irritation when you're really relaxed. You can't hold anxiety and fear. It doesn't stick. It sort of passes. So that coming back to the body, very, very helpful, very, very important. There's old duffers. We've been around. One of the things is, on a certain level, you know, as you continue to practice and your practice deepens, it gets simpler. Not in that it's easy, but there's a simplification, and it becomes much more direct. And that, that's very encouraging as well. It's that sense of, yeah, this is a very direct path. That's one of the sort of the epithets of the, when we do the chanting of the recollection of the Dhamma. It's visible here and now. It's not an intellectual, philosophical, metaphysical. This is sort of deep tissue. Freedom from suffering or recognition. Or there's something there.
Personal. Have you had a unique experience by going to St. Quentin and counseling the young man before he was executed? What's your feeling of the death penalty, having that experience?
Oh, it's a disaster.
Would you like to relate some of your experiences? Because it's a unique experience which you had.
Yes, it was unique. For those who might not know, I think it was 1999. I was invited to go to San Quentin Prison, which is a maximum security prison in the state of California. And there was a Thai man who had been incarcerated for 16 years, and his appeals had run out, and he had actually been scheduled for execution in November, and then it was called off, 9, 10 o'clock at night. He was supposed to be executed at midnight, and they didn't actually tell him till after midnight. Yeah. and then his execution came up again in February, and he had a spiritual advisor. You're allowed to have a spiritual advisor at the one person at the leading up to the execution, and he had had one who had been a prison chaplain, but they knew each other very well, and there was, you know, an attachment and concern there. So it set up a kind of a dynamic that he was kind of looking after her, and he really wanted to be on his own when he was coming up to his execution, because he knew what he needed to do. After about around 5 years of being in prison, he had the realization that one, that he was definitely going to die in prison. I mean, he had already been sentenced to death, you know, prior to that, but the way the mind works, that you can distance yourself from that. But then he had the strong recognition that he was going to die in prison, and he could either die as an angry, suffering being, or he could make the effort to really change himself and go through and make a commitment to real inner work. As is custom in Thailand, he'd been a monk temporarily for 3 months and had done some study and meditation. And so then he started reviewing and reestablishing his roots of that practice. And it was quite, he didn't speak, when his English was not very good when he was first in prison, so that he learned English in prison. He became, he's quite an accomplished poet and in English and painter. He'd done his artwork. He'd learned how to paint in prison. So he used art as a way of kind of focusing his mind. But then he did a lot of meditation and trying to get as many Buddhist books as he could, which were, he was probably the only Thai person in his prison. And of course he's in maximum security, death row, limited access to resources. So through that difficulty, he really grew. And I was able to go there by the time I was invited, it was with almost less than a week before the execution, and things happened very quickly, which was very rare. I got security clearance and was able to go in and spent the last 3 days with him. And The first day was very interesting because he was so excited. He was going to be able to offer a meal to the monk. And then he had friends, lawyers, and you could see that he had special privileges because you're in death row and your execution is coming up, so they separate you from the other prisoners. But he also had special privileges just because who he was. He had really gained the trust and I think respect of the guards, prison officials, so that he had a lot of leeway. I mean, he could walk around. Normally a prisoner like that would be, he was chained to the waist, his wrists were chained. Normally he'd be shackled and then he'd be chained in a chair, and then there would be guards in four corners and guards outside the door. So that was, and he had it, but he had a receiving room, but he was able to walk around, talk to people, receive people. There's only one guard outside, and one guard inside. And what he did, he wanted me to explain Buddhism to these people that had helped him, and so that was very touching. And then we had time also to really focus on him, because he was the one who was going to be executed in a few days. So that I had during the visiting hours from about 9 o'clock in the morning till two, those first 2 days, then the last day, they didn't allow anybody except close family. So, and then we were alone all that time. And then as it leads up to the execution, then they take you to the actual execution chamber. Right next to it, there's a holding cells. So then I was locked in a cell, he was locked in an adjacent cell, and then we could communicate between the bars and a corner. And we had, there was a guard sitting and watching him, there was a guard sitting and watching me, there was a guard in the corner, a guard in this corner, and there were two other guards that were circulating, and they would change, six guards around all the time. So, you know, it wasn't a wonderfully peaceful environment. So, but his own sincerity and my presence and assistance, I think it would change the whole atmosphere. We were able to spend, the whole 3 days was very intense. And in the sense of really focusing on what mattered, how to establish the mind at death. And he was very able to do that, very composed, very clear, and no blame, no criticism, no kind of sense of apprehension. At his execution, I wasn't a witness to it myself. I was still kept in a holding cell. And he followed my instructions and just said, don't pay, they're gonna, as soon as you walk out of here, then you'll be strapped in a chair, just forget the body, bring the attention to the breath, meditation, turn the attention to quality of light, and because it was through lethal injection, so that the particular cocktail of medicines that they give are to stop the heart and stop the breathing at this pretty much immediately. So it just clunk, things shut down. So, but he was really able to be able to just let the body go, let that go. And the next day, we had a cremation ceremony, and I had them open the kind of coffin, cardboard box coffin and body bag that he was in. And I particularly wanted his sister to be able to see, because I felt that he was fine. And we opened the body bag just this very, very beautiful expression on his face. Very, very, no kind of tension, no kind of, it was very, very beautiful. So that it was he'd been really able to use the whole circumstance. And my own time was helpful to him, but I think without his own commitment and his ability to really give himself to practice and take on his impending death, then what I would have been able to do in a short period of time wouldn't have been much, but because he'd laid such a good foundation, and it was very helpful for me to be there, because it was again for him to have that. And it was interesting because at first he wasn't keen on having anybody with him, and then when he heard there was one of the lawyers wanted to invite this Buddhist monk, then he was indifferent, because he felt he had his own foundation already, and if he didn't know, because there's all sorts of Buddhist monks around, and if that, I think he realized that, if somebody came who wasn't grounded, then it would be a distraction for him as well. So he really wanted to focus on his own process of dying, transition. The San Quentin prison was built in about begin to be built in about 1860, and it has this tremendous feeling of like a medieval dungeon. It's like your kind of your worst image of a scary dungeon, and you go through all these gates. It's really it's a miserable place to be in. And when we were going there, I asked the guard who was taking me down, accompanying me, how many people are awaiting on death row? And at that time, which is several years ago, there was 540. That's just in California. And one of his friends, who in prison, they were next door cells. He's just recently been released because he'd been in prison for over 20 years, and it wasn't there. So the death sentence is I don't think it's very, very useful. Just in terms of economics, it's more expensive to execute somebody than it is to have them in prison.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhayami suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho Sanghang Namami.